A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 3, Being Good and Being Wise. Can Virtue Be Taught?
The title of this lecture is Being Good and Being Wise. It's about Socrates and the role of reason in ethics. Socrates was born in the 5th century BC during the so-called Golden Age of Athens, the Age of Pericles. He died in 399 BC, an easy reference point date to remember, at the age of 70, condemned to death by a jury of 501 citizens for the crime of not believing in the gods of the state. All philosophy after him stems from Socrates, and since most of the sciences are spin-offs from philosophy, it's not much of an exaggeration to say that half of Western culture depends on Socrates. No one man in history, except Jesus, has ever made more of a difference to history. Every school of ancient philosophy, except for materialistic Epicureanism, claimed to be the true disciples of Socrates, rather like every Christian church and denomination claiming to be the true disciples of Jesus. The difference between Socrates and preceding philosophers is so much greater than the difference between any of his successors that all his predecessors are lumped together in a category called the pre-Socratics. What made Socrates so different was not so much new ideas as a whole new way of thinking, a kind of skeleton key that would open any number of doors previously closed to human thought, a new power tool for thinking. Socrates was the first person in history to have a clear idea of what a logical argument was, when a point was really proved to be true. He used the so-called Socratic method of questioning an idea as a lawyer would question a witness in court, and doing it in a logical, step-by-step way so that if you accepted certain premises as true, he could show you that you necessarily had to accept certain conclusions as true too, because these conclusions logically followed from those premises. If all A is B and all B is C, then it absolutely must be true that all A is C. This may sound very simple and obvious to us, but Socrates first discovered and practiced this art. Logical reasoning had always been an innate power of the human mind, but it seems to have awoke from sleep for the first time in Socrates. In Socrates, for the first time, reason became aware of itself, became a differentiated psychic function, as William Barrett puts it in Irrational Man, his fascinating book on modern existentialism and how it fits into the history of Western philosophy. Barrett contrasts Oriental civilization with Western civilization and asks the simple question why science arose in the West, and why Oriental man, who is no less brilliant and profound than Western man, always remained intuitive and mystical rather than rational and scientific. And his answer, in one word, is Socrates and his successors. And, fortunately for us who are using him here in this series of lectures on ethics, Socrates applied his new method only to one subject, ethics. He was not interested in the physical universe, as most of the other Greeks were, or in the arts or in politics, but only in ethics. And his most important teaching was the one that connected these two things, reason and ethics, by claiming that virtue is knowledge and vice is ignorance, that if you really know the good, if you really know what is good for you, then you will do it. Thus, all evil doing is rooted in ignorance. He didn't mean ignorance of facts, but ignorance of values, moral ignorance. Now, this sounds ridiculous at first, to say that virtue is knowledge and vice is ignorance, because we all know of brilliant villains, like the Marquis de Sade, and simple-minded heroes, like Forrest Gump. Intellectuals are no more virtuous than other people, it seems. So what could Socrates possibly mean by saying that virtue is knowledge and vice is ignorance? We have all had the experience of knowing what is good and what is evil, what we ought to do and what we ought not to do, and yet choosing the evil rather than the good. Socrates was not unaware of this fact. How did he explain it? The answer is found in one of the greatest speeches ever made, Socrates' Apology, his defense before the court that condemned him to death. Apology did not mean admission of guilt, but argument in defense. Apologetics is the art of defending your beliefs. It doesn't mean, oops, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry at all. I'm right, and I'll prove it. In this speech, Socrates tells the story of how he became a philosopher. He's on trial for atheism, for not believing in the gods approved by the state. And this story answers that charge by showing how pious he really was. One of the holiest shrines in Greece was the temple to the god Apollo on the island of Delphi. There lived the Delphic oracle, who was a prophetess, the Sibyl, a woman supposedly inspired by Apollo, who would give guaranteed true answers to any question. But the answers were in the form of riddles, whose meaning came clear only later. Now, even the Greeks who were skeptical of the gods, and there were quite a few of these by Socrates' time, they usually believed in the oracle, because her predictions always somehow seemed to come true. Well, one day, when Socrates was still a young man, and only a stonecutter, and not yet a philosopher, Socrates' friend Chaerephon got to see the oracle and ask her one question. And his question was, "Is there anyone in this world wiser than my friend Socrates?" And the oracle answered, "No." And when Chaerephon went home and told Socrates what the oracle said, Socrates was totally astounded. He proudly dropped the stone he was cutting on his foot, because he knew that he had no wisdom at all. How could he be the wisest man in the world? Now comes the part of the story that proves his piety. Instead of just dismissing the oracle as a fraud, he assumed that a god cannot lie, and therefore she had spoken the truth. So he demanded to understand the meaning of this riddle. So he went around trying to find someone wiser than himself, so that he could take that person to the oracle and say, "Oracle, you said no one is wiser than I, yet here is so-and-so, and he is wiser than I. Please explain your riddle." But he never got to go to the oracle with that wise man, because he never found one. What he found instead was that everybody thought that they had wisdom, but upon cross-examination, no one really had it. And this was the way Socrates developed the art of cross-examination, the Socratic method. Thus, the oracle inveigled Socrates to become a philosopher. The oracle's riddle was the catalyst that produced that reaction in Socrates, the discovery of the method of logical cross-examination, the art that was to remain philosophy's method down through the centuries. For instance, Socrates would approach a politician renowned for his wisdom and ask him, "Oh, great and wise politician, what are you wise about?" "About justice, Socrates. That's my thing, justice." "Well then," Socrates would say, "could you please answer me the simplest possible question about it? The very first question that a beginner would ask, that a child would ask." "Well, of course, Socrates. What do you want to know?" "Well, to start with, I want to know what it is. What is justice? Could you please give me a definition so I don't confuse it with injustice?" "Oh, Socrates, everybody knows what justice is." "Oh, well then, you know too, right?" "Of course." "Well, please tell me, because I don't know." "Well, that's easy, Socrates. Justice means paying back what you owe." And Socrates would say, "Thank you, sir." But he wouldn't just leave it there. He'd ask more questions about the definition. He would say something like this, "I'm not sure I understand your definition. Do you mean, for instance, that if I owned this weapon and I lent it to you, and then I became a homicidal maniac and wanted it to kill you with, that it would be just for you to give me my weapon back while I was in that state?" "No, of course not, Socrates." "Well, then justice is not always paying what is owed, because it would be paying what is owed for you to give me back my weapon, but that would not be just. So please tell me what justice is, what it always is, necessarily is, universally is, by its essence." And then the politician would mumble and warn Socrates not to be a troublemaker, and Socrates would go home thinking that he had indeed learned a lesson, not what justice is, but what wisdom is. This man thought he was wise, but was not. Socrates knew he was not wise, and thus he was. So he came to the conclusion, after a lifetime of such encounters, most of them much more complex than this one, and many of them written up in Plato's charming dialogues, he came to the conclusion that the oracle was right after all. Even though Socrates had no wisdom, yet no one was wiser than he, because he at least knew that he had no wisdom, while no one else did. That's why he kept asking questions that no one else did. So he learned that there were only two kinds of people in the world, fools who think that they are wise, and the wise who know that they are fools. And he tried to teach others that wisdom, that they are fools, that they need wisdom, that they need to inquire. That is wisdom's lesson one, and no one can get to any lesson two without lesson one. Well, this Socratic paradox may be charming and even profound, but you may be wondering what it has to do with ethics. Everything. Here lies the key to understanding Socrates' most important ethical teaching, that virtue is knowledge. He didn't mean just any kind of knowledge. He meant self-knowledge. The first step to moral virtue is to know yourself. And that meant, first of all, to know how foolish and unwise you are, and thus to search for the wisdom you know you don't have. But it also meant a second thing. This self-knowledge meant to know human nature, to know what kind of a thing you were as a human being. Over the temple of Apollo at Delphi was this inscription, Apollo's first law, know thyself. That was the key to ethics, Socrates thought. Socrates practiced obedience to Apollo's first and greatest commandment better than anyone else in Greece. Ironically, the only man that democratic Athens ever executed for a religious crime was really the most religious man Athens ever produced. The parallels to Jesus are quite remarkable. In the Apology, Socrates taught a very strange paradox, yet it's one of the few things he claimed to be certain of. He says, "Be sure of this. If you kill me, you will not harm me, but yourselves. For the eternal law makes it impossible that a good man ever be harmed by a bad one." And he repeats this at the very end of his speech as his parting shot, his swan song, his most certain wisdom that he leaves to us before he dies. He says, "Know this, it is impossible for a good man to suffer evil, either in this world or in the next." In other words, Socrates' answer to the great problem of evil, why bad things happen to good people, is that they never do. Now, this sounds simply ridiculous. Here is a good man, Socrates, suffering the evil of injustice, misunderstanding, imprisonment, and death at the hands of bad men, and from the middle of this situation, he says that this never happens. Like the oracle, Socrates is giving us a puzzle, and it takes wisdom to solve it. That's part of his method. He's helping us to be wise by his indirect method, not telling us the answer, so all we have to do is believe it and remember it, but telling us the question instead, the puzzle, and we have to find the answer, and in the process become wise. So what is the answer? Remember Apollo's puzzle, know thyself. The question does not mean what personal feelings and unique experiences have you had in your life. It means, what is a human being? What is the essence of man? If you find the answer to that question, then you will understand Socrates' paradox about it being impossible for a good man to suffer any evil, in this world or in any other, even though Socrates claimed to know nothing for certain about the next world. All he had was hopes. What is the link between these two ideas? Evil cannot be done to a good man. Why? Because of the answer to know thyself, because of what a man is. Let's figure out what that essence is. Bad men are doing bad things to good Socrates. They take away his honor, his reputation, his freedom, his possessions, his very life. What can't they take from him? His virtue and his wisdom. Where is that? Not in his reputation, in other people's minds, and not in his possessions, and not in his body, but in his soul. Socrates discovered that the true self is the soul. Socrates' answer to Apollo's question, know thyself, is that the self is the soul, the inner self, the personality, the character. And that's why no evil can ever happen to you, and why bad people can't harm good people. evil that happens to you comes from outside and can harm only your body. The only evil that harms your very self comes from you, folly and vice. No one else can make you foolish or vicious, and no one else can make you wise or virtuous. Not society, but you are the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This discovery was a radical revolution in the history of human consciousness. Today, we quite naturally speak of the self as the personality, the who rather than just the what, the body. But this is due mainly to Socrates. The Greek word for soul was psyche, psyche, from which we get our word psychology. Before Socrates, that word meant ghost. In Homer and Hesiod and Aeschylus, when you die, you don't live again. You are down there in the grave. Only your ghost survives, a pale copy of the living self you once were. In movies today, we still usually see this old pre-Socratic notion of the self. When somebody dies, they show his soul emerging from his body as a ghost, a fog, a thin thing, something less than the body. But for Socrates, it's the body that's the fog, the thin thing, the thing that doesn't last very long. The soul is more like an iron bar, if you want a concrete image for it. The soul is the solid, substantial, immortal, unkillable thing. It's the body that's the ghost. Now, if Socrates had come right out and said that the true self is the soul, what his contemporaries would have heard him saying was that the true self is the ghost, because that's what the word psyche meant before Socrates. And that would have seemed like nonsense. But Socrates gave a radically new meaning to the word psyche, or soul. And when Christianity came into the world some 4 centuries later, it found in the worldwide Greek language, the language the New Testament was written in, it found in that language a ready-made word for the self. Unlike Socrates, Christianity also taught the resurrection of the body, as well as the immortality of the soul. But the concept of the soul as the self, the personality, the I, which Christianity used when it came into the world, this concept most of us have of ourselves today, it was first clearly discovered by Socrates. So, know thyself is the key that explains the paradox of evil. Evil cannot just happen to the true self. It can only be freely chosen by the self. And if happiness comes from goodness, from having a good self, then happiness cannot just happen either. It is chosen. We are responsible for our own happiness. And that's why no evil, or good for that matter, can just happen to a good man. Because the man equals his soul. Now, even if you disagree with Socrates and say that the body is also part of your identity and not some external thing like a hotel room, even if you have the biblical Judeo-Christian notion of the body rather than the Socratic one, still, this Socratic insight can be largely true. True insofar as the soul is closer to your essence than your body, more inward. It may not be everything, but it's primary. The body may not be nothing, but it's secondary. Jesus seems to say something a lot like Socrates when he says to the Pharisees that evil can't come to you through things like ritual impurities, like eating with unwashed hands or unwashed vessels, but only from within, from your own heart. And this know thyself principle also explains our other paradox, the one that we began this lecture with, that virtue is knowledge, that if you only know the good, then you will do it, that all evil comes from ignorance. This is a tremendously important point because if it's true, then we have isolated the cause of evil, and to know the cause is to know the cure. What could be more important than that? I want to show you how revolutionary this idea is. First, let's assume something that we all know to be true from our own experience, that we all seek our own good, not our own harm. We may will harm or evil or unhappiness to others, but we never will what we think is bad for ourselves. Everyone always seeks the apparent good for himself. That's just a psychological fact. Now, let's assume a second thing, that you know yourself, and that you know that the self is the soul, and that your own true good is therefore the good of your soul. You know yourself well enough to know that happiness is not in the body any more than weight or color is in the soul. Now let's assume a third thing, that you know your soul well enough to know that virtue is the only way to happiness, because virtue is health of soul. Let's assume you really know that, know it without doubt. Well, if you really know these three things without any uncertainty or doubt, what would follow? Well, we always seek our own apparent good, and if we know that our self is our soul, and our good is our soul's good, and if we know that our soul's good is virtue, why, then we'd always seek virtue and never vice, always good and never evil. If our mind absolutely glued together the psychological good and the moral good, happiness and virtue, then we would never seek vice but always seek virtue, because we always seek happiness. Now you can see the Socratic revolution and why he thought the mind was the key to being good. By the mind here, Socrates meant not cleverness, not calculation, and not just factual knowledge, but wisdom, moral wisdom, understanding of true values. Not the kind of knowledge we call science, not even the ordinary kind of factual knowledge of the world that science refines and perfects, but self-knowledge, knowledge of what it is to be a human being, knowledge of the meaning of human life, in short, wisdom. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. Philosophy was really Socrates' religion. The ancient Greeks defined man as the rational animal. Reason, they thought, was what essentially distinguished us from all the other animals. To the modern mind, that definition seems too narrow, because we think of reason as something computers do, and we are more than animals plus computers. We are moral agents. We all have self-consciousness, and we wonder and doubt and question, and we have an aesthetic sense and a sense of beauty and imagination, and we're capable of religion, thinking about ultimate reality and changing our lives according to any of these things. But that's exactly what the ancients meant by reason, when they defined man as the rational animal. The meaning of the term reason has narrowed radically since the scientific revolution. Science has co-opted the meaning of rationality, so that all those other things I listed, none of which can be done by the scientific method, all those things have ceased to come under what we mean by reason. But it did come under what the ancients meant by reason. So when Socrates says that the key to practicing virtue is reason, he's not thinking of IQ or factual knowledge or cleverness, but understanding, standing under, not just knowing that certain propositions are true rather than false, but standing in them as you would stand in the sunlight. If you really understand not just the propositions, but the reality that you are essentially your soul and that the happiness of your soul comes only through virtue, why, then you will love virtue as you love yourself and your own happiness. And if you don't love virtue that way, if you love vice instead sometimes, then it must be because you don't really understand, at least at those times. You see the forbidden thing as something desirable. You see the evil as a good. You see the subjectively satisfying good as the greater good than the moral good. Or maybe you see the temporary satisfaction, the temporary happiness that you get from this wrong thing, as more important than the long-range, deep happiness that you get from choosing the right thing. So evil comes only when you see wrongly, when you understand wrongly, when your human reason is not working properly. Take a specific case. Say you are poor, and you'd like to be rich because then you could buy things that would give you pleasure. Let's say you're also poor in wisdom. You confuse yourself with your body and its material goods and pleasures, and you identify the good life with the life of the power to get whatever you desire. Now, let's say you're not completely devoid of moral wisdom. Let's say you also know that you ought to do right and not wrong, and you know what things are right and what things are wrong, as everybody does. Now, you're driving down the street one day, and you see a bank robbery, and the robbers drop a sack of bills on their way out, and nobody sees it but you, and you pick it up and put it in your car. Now, what do you do with it? Do you keep it, or do you give it back to the bank? You know it's not rightly yours, so you know you ought to give it back. At least, aren't you tempted to keep it, though? It doesn't feel like stealing. You would never have planned that robbery yourself. You're not a professional thief. You're not even tempted to be one, but you are tempted to keep that money. Why? Because you don't really believe that virtue always makes you happy. And you don't really believe that happiness is a matter of your soul, not your bank account or your body. Because you are essentially your soul, your mind and will, your character. You don't know that. You don't believe that. Not completely, deep down, without doubts. So because you aren't wise enough to know your true self, you think that maybe a little moral evil might be worth it because it will sometimes give you a lot of happiness. Suppose that instead of a sack of money, the thieves had dropped a sack of cockroaches. You wouldn't be tempted to steal them. Why? Because you see the true value of cockroaches. You know they can't make you happy. You'd have to be crazy to think that. You'd have to think you were a cockroach. But you do think the money can make you happy because you don't know yourself. You don't think of yourself as a soul, but as a bank account. Now, if ignorance is the cause of evil, wisdom is the cure. To remove the effect, remove the cause. So to remove evil, remove ignorance. Thus, for Socrates' philosophy, the love of wisdom is the cure for moral evil. Well, why hasn't the cure worked, then? It sounds so reasonable. What's wrong with Socrates' argument? There's certainly a lot of truth in it. The mind plays an indispensable part in both good and evil. Animals are not moral agents, because even though some animals are very intelligent, they have only very clever instincts. They don't have rational minds, self-conscious minds, minds that can say, I, minds with consciences, capable of guilt and not just shame. Without a working mind, there's no moral good or evil. So the mind must have some indispensable role to play in determining whether we will be good or evil. Socrates is clearly right there. But is the mind the only factor? It's true that the mind is the soul's only light, like the navigator or the instruments on a ship. We always steer by the light we have, and all that light comes from the mind. Socrates is right. We do always seek the apparent good. So there is moral ignorance behind every moral evil. What then did he leave out? I think he left out the will. The will is like the captain of the ship. The captain has the power to tell the navigator to shut up or to speak. And when we reflect on our own experience of having done evil, I think we always find both the mind and the will playing a part. We do find what Socrates says, the apparent attractiveness of the evil that we are tempted to, and thus, behind that apparent attractiveness, ignorance, a lack of wisdom. But what caused the lack of wisdom? When you see that money and you realize that you're free to steal it without being caught, at that moment, something in you tells you the moral truth. You know that moral evil will not make you happy, not really, not deep down, not in the long run. But there's something else in you that wants to shut that voice down. Something else in you wants that money, wants the satisfaction of the desires that the stolen money could give you, and that something else wants you to listen to it rather than to the moral voice. It's like the old stock cartoon where an angel speaks to you in one ear and a demon in the other. One voice comes from your reason, your conscience, what Freud calls your superego, but it's really yours, not just society's, as Freud thinks. And the other voice comes from your desires, what Freud calls your id. And here's the point. You cast the deciding vote. There's a third thing in your soul that Freud calls the ego, the I or self. That's you. That's the heart of you. You tell one of those two voices to speak and the other one to shut up. You command your thoughts. Your will commands your mind to turn to one set of thoughts or another. The captain orders the navigator around. So you are responsible not just for your actions, but also for your thoughts. I don't think Socrates saw that. But the other two great teachers did. I mean Buddha and Jesus. The first line of the most popular book in Buddhism, the Dhammapada, goes something like this. All that we are is determined by our thoughts. It begins where our thoughts begin. It moves where our thoughts move. It ends where our thoughts end. If we think thoughts like, he hurt me, he stole from me, he is my enemy, then our life and our destiny will follow that thought as the wheel follows the axle. And if we think thoughts like, he cannot hurt me, only I can hurt myself, he cannot steal from me, he cannot be my enemy, only I can be my enemy, then our life and our destiny will follow those thoughts. And Jesus was constantly criticizing those respectable, self-righteous Pharisees, even though their deeds seemed morally respectable, because of their thoughts. He turned ethics from an outward to an inward focus on the thoughts of the heart. And St. Paul said in one of his letters, take every thought captive and have the mind of Christ. So for both the Buddhist and the Christian, thoughts are tremendously important. Right mindfulness is probably the most important part of the Buddhist Noble Eightfold Path. But thoughts are to be controlled by a deeper source, a more mysterious center, which we in the West often call the heart or the will. Heart not in the sense of sentiments, but in the sense of the very center of the soul. I don't think Socrates quite reached that point. The question then remains, how right is Socrates? How much can the mind do to make us good? Can virtue be taught at all? Can we have moral education? Should our schools be making its students not only smarter, but better? Even if virtue is not merely knowledge, how much of it is knowledge? Plato raised that question in a dialogue called the Meno. It begins with Meno asking Socrates, can you tell me, Socrates, can virtue be taught? Or does it come to man in some other way, by habit and practice? Or does he have virtue innately, by nature? Or does he get it in some other way, against nature? These four ways Meno mentions in which we might become virtuous or morally good correspond to the four main philosophies that would appear in the next 2,400 years, both in the West and in the East. Do we get virtue by teaching, by habit, by nature, or against nature? The most optimistic answer is that we have it by nature. Our very essence is to be virtuous. That would be Rousseau's answer in the 18th century. The next most optimistic answer is that virtue can come by teaching. That was Plato's answer. All you have to do is make the mind wise, then everything else will follow. The next answer, a little less optimistic, is that it takes work, effort, practice, development of habits. That's Aristotle's answer. He says we are by nature not virtuous or vicious, and that moral virtues come to us only by practice. Only the intellectual virtues, the excellences of the mind, come by teaching. So, if Plato were living today, he would expect our schools to do moral education, but Aristotle would not. He would expect that to come outside the schools, in your own life and work and family. Finally, the most pessimistic answer is that virtue comes against human nature, by force. We are by nature bad and have to be compelled to be good by force or fear. That would be Machiavelli's answer in the 17th century and Hobbes in the 18th. We find in Chinese philosophy the same four answers. Lao Tzu, like Rousseau, taught that we are virtuous by nature. Confucius taught a combination of Plato's answer and Aristotle's answer. Virtue comes by teaching and by habit. Finally, the school called the realists taught the opposite of Lao Tzu's optimism. They said that all social problems could be solved by two words, hit them. It's remarkable that Plato summarized the four answers to this most important question that would be given by the next 2,400 years of philosophy in the first paragraph of his dialogue. There are two questions here. First, can you tell me, Socrates? And second, can virtue be taught, or does it come in one of those other ways? In the Meno, Socrates gives a definite answer to the first question, can you tell me? But not to the second, can virtue be taught? Because he's not in the business of answering questions, but getting us to ask them. He doesn't tell, he teaches. Teaching is contrasted to telling. Teaching takes place by questioning, not by lecturing. So we have to find the answer for ourselves to the second question, can virtue be taught? Socrates helps us to find the answer in two ways. First, he says he doesn't know, teaching us his favorite lesson one. showing he's wiser than Meno, who says he does know. Second, he points out that we have to follow a logical order. We can't know whether virtue can be taught until we know what virtue is. Unless we know what a thing is, unless we know its nature or essence expressed in a definition, we literally don't know what we're talking about. So the first question is, what is virtue? And then he shows us, as he shows Meno, that we don't know what virtue is, even though we think we do. All Meno's definitions are shown to be logically inadequate. And then, when Meno won't think for himself any further, and just wants to give up and go home, Meno gives Socrates an argument for skepticism, the comfortable idea that nobody can ever know the truth with certainty anyway. So Socrates spends a long time refuting skepticism by showing that everyone really has a hidden storehouse of knowledge in the mind, innately. He says that learning is really remembering what we would call unconscious knowledge, drawing it up into the conscious mind, like calling up the data in a computer onto the screen. We have to know the access code, what buttons to push. Socrates pushes our buttons by his Socratic method of logical questioning. He not only teaches this doctrine that learning is remembering, but then shows it by teaching Meno's uneducated slave boy an advanced lesson in geometry, the Pythagorean theorem, just by drawing some pictures in the sand and asking the boy some questions about them. He doesn't tell the boy any answers. He only helps him to find them himself. Now, a machine or an animal couldn't do that. Only a human being could. But any human being could. Even a slave who's never been to school. So, skepticism is now refuted, and Meno has no excuse for not trying again to find the truth about what virtue is and whether it can be taught. But poor Meno refuses to think for himself. So, Socrates makes him think by confusing him. Instead of telling him the answer, Socrates takes both sides of the dialogue and first proves that virtue is knowledge and that it therefore can be taught, and then he proves that virtue cannot be taught because there are no teachers of it, and so it is not knowledge. Socrates, I think, realizes there's two sides to this issue. He knows that his theory that virtue is knowledge and can be taught seems to be contradicted by practice, contradicted in experience. Even the best and most virtuous teachers, Pericles, and even Socrates himself, did not succeed in teaching virtue to their own children. So he leaves us in a dilemma. And finally, at the end of the dialogue, he suggests a way out of the dilemma, that virtue is neither certain knowledge nor mere ignorance, but a sort of knowledge, namely right opinion or belief. And it is neither simply teachable by men, as geometry is, nor not teachable at all, but teachable in a way. He says only God can teach it, but we can help. So the truth is somewhere between simply yes and simply no. Socrates' final answers here raise the question of the relation between philosophy and religion. For when he says that virtue is right opinion or right belief, the two words for that in Greek are orthos and doxa, and when you put them together, you make up the word orthodoxy. So virtue seems to be faith, which is a kind of knowledge, but not by proof, not by reason. Socrates seems to be suggesting that if you really believe that you are a soul and that virtue makes you happy, then that will work as well as knowledge. That will motivate you to practice virtue so that it will still be true that virtue is a kind of knowledge, although a knowledge by faith rather than proof. And virtue can be taught, he says, but not by man, but only by God. Socrates never claimed to teach virtue, yet all his teaching was about virtue. Perhaps he saw himself as the instrument of God, a kind of prophet without a doctrine, a prophet who revealed not answers but questions and a method. Scholars disagree as to whether Socrates was serious in his answers here, because they're religious answers to philosophical questions. Perhaps he was deliberately giving us a weak answer to force us to find a better one. For Socrates certainly did not think that religious faith in the gods of his society, the gods approved by the state, was going to make you virtuous. Those gods themselves were not virtuous. They were terrible role models for mortals. Socrates was executed because he could not honestly proclaim his faith in any of the gods named by the state. So perhaps he meant another kind of faith in another kind of god. He never spoke seriously of the Greek gods, but he did speak seriously of the God, a single unknown God whom he never claimed to know or name. Well, this raises the whole question of the relation between ethics and religion. They seem connected in some way, but how? Is ethics dependent on religion? Is a thing right just because the gods say so? Or is it an alternative to religion, a better alternative that uses reason instead of faith and attains knowledge instead of belief? Or is it a different kind of religion, a more pure and rational religion? That's the question we'll look at next time in a dialogue called The Euthyphro. If you can, I advise that you read that dialogue before listening to the next lecture.
After listening to Lecture 3, a student posed this question to Professor Kraft. Why don't more people do good if it leads to happiness? Let's listen to the professor's response.
Okay, here is the really difficult question. If everybody seeks happiness, and if most people know that doing good is the road to happiness, then why don't we do good? We'd have to be crazy to deliberately choose unhappiness over happiness. Are we crazy or are we stupid? Well, Socrates thinks we're stupid. I think we're crazy. I think that in many cases, we deliberately prefer something other than happiness, other than joy. We pick a fight with somebody and they want to reconcile and we don't. Our pride is hurt. It hurts. We prefer to be hurt. We envy somebody. Envy is one sin that never caused anybody a moment of pleasure, and yet we do it. There's something very mysterious in us that Socrates didn't know about. We're all crazy. We're all addicted to something that we know is harmful for us, and yet we do it.
This ends Lecture 3.